Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan. Glad to be with my wonderful audience. You know, this show means a lot to me, folks. I want you to know that if you're benefiting from it, you're not the only one. The opportunity to interview interesting and worthwhile people every week and to get to know new people on a weekly basis often is just really something to be cherished. I really look forward to the shows. I enjoy creating an environment that's friendly and caring. I enjoy having on people with whom I'm in enough fundamental agreement that I don't have to be presenting my own views except as they may liven up the show or enhance them. Doing a radio show like this is really a gift. And I also want to thank PRN. They haven't asked me to do this, but I want to thank PRN. And I hope its listenership will just continue to grow, and I hope that those of you out there will support this great station with great diversity and a great team working, backing those of us up who go on the air. Catching up you a little bit with me, I have the series of six simple truths about psychiatry that I put up some time ago. We've been getting really tens of thousands of people watching them. And I've now started to put up another series. And the first one is up. It's you can get it off my website, Bregan.com, or you can get it off of YouTube. And this one is about psychiatric drugs are much worse than you can imagine. And this is a really important simple truth. Psychiatric drugs are far worse than you can imagine, than most people think, than the enormous universe of doctors and psychiatrists think. And I just want to draw it to your attention. I don't think I've ever specifically promoted one of the individual of the first six of Simple Truths, but this is one that's worth letting the world hear about. And we also have up on our web page now, and functioning properly, there was a time when the purchase mechanism wasn't working, the Advanced Orders for Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, subtitle Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. This is a book that I put literally my heart and soul into, as well as some very unusual and original thinking, I believe, about the biological origins of guilt, shame, and anxiety. Not something you might expect from me, the biological origins of guilt, shame, and anxiety, and how they're reinforced in childhood. And the book's price is, I think, $19. We're giving you the book plus the antidepressant fact book, which itself sells for like $14 or $15. So we're giving away the antidepressant fact book if you buy an advance order of Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, which won't be out until December 2nd, 3rd, or 4th in that region. And somewhere around then, the mailings to you would begin from us. And if you go and check the book out, I also have a short video that I just put up on my website on the book page for Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, just briefly tweaking you about the book. I'm very, very excited about publishing something that is so oriented toward helping rather than just being critical. Now, all my books have helping sections in them, virtually all, but this whole book is about understanding and overcoming your, what I call, negative legacy emotions, legacies from evolution and legacies from childhood that we don't need to live by as adults. Now, my guest today is a man who brings huge experience. I think he's as old as I am, maybe a little younger, I'm not sure. I don't know if he's going to want to tell us. Keen, are you there?
Nothing.
Hi, can you hear me good?
You bet. In fact, I can hear your station engineer, I call him an engineer, called me because I couldn't get through on that 88 number you folks gave me. So I was glad, except he didn't know who I was, so he didn't know who he was calling, poor fella.
Well, you know, that's
maybe life. Maybe have to give him some anti-anxiety pills, huh?
Yes, there was a little anxiety before the show because for some reason, and I don't want to go into it, this is a great program. I love the folks who do it. But there were some connectivity issues for a little bit there.
Okay.
But Keen, his last name, his first name is Keen, K-E-E-N-E.
And
his
last name. Really my middle name, but go ahead.
Why don't you pronounce your last name for us?
Yeah, it's a German-Austrian name, Hiftli. When the people came to America, there was an umlaut over the U. You might know how to pronounce it. It's I. Well, there's no sound, as you know, no phoneme in our English language. So those people put a lot of just put an E behind the U. So it's Hiftli, means little hip.
Hiftli.
Means
and,
little hip, yeah.
So again, and you can find him on the internet. He's a PhD. He comes from a far-flung place called Idaho now. I know a little about Idaho because I've given two talks in the last couple of months, one in Iowa, which everybody confuses with Idaho, and the other in Nebraska, which is right near Idaho. And it turns out that because I spoke at the University of Nebraska in Kearney, and I'm not sure I'm saying Kearney right. How do you say Kearney?
You're not saying it right. I grew up 60 miles west of Kearney, which is Kearney, Nebraska.
Kearney, that's right.
And it's right in the center of the United States. When you were in Kearney, you were in the center of the United States.
Yes, and it isn't spelled Kearney, but that's what it is. That's
K-E-A-R-N-E-Y. It is now part of the University of Nebraska in Lincoln.
Yep. So we're talking from flyover country, or as I prefer to think of it, heartland. And Keen is he's a licensed psychologist. He does individual and family counseling, which I think is always the best way to go because I think when you can do family counseling – you're helping in a much more powerful way in many more people. And he's, in fact, board certified in marriage and relationship counseling. He also does neurolinguistic programming. We've had a little bit on the show about NLP. I'm probably a little bit of a skeptic. He also does some has been certified in hypnotherapy. And he's, you know, he's got some good educational background, done a lot of different things. I don't know why I have all these certificates, transactional analysis, gestalt psychotherapy. But you've published many articles. You've also been in the public news. And you published a book called Intrinsic versus Extrinsic Motivational Strategies for Classroom Teachers and Parents. So we could get into teaching as well. We could talk about bird watching. There's a lot we could talk about today, but we can start by how we met. My wife read a blog that Keen wrote, critical of Dr. Drew, who was diagnosing Robin Williams after his death. And Keen, as I did, you know, just didn't take very well to this. So let's hear about Dr. Drew, you and Dr. Drew.
Well, let's do this, and So, Dr. Bragan, Peter, let as to what the happening was that brought us together, which is what you're alluding to, the death of Robert Williams. It was that evening that I was just happened to be spending some time surfing the TV, and there on HLN or CNN was Dr. Drew, and he was telling the world what he knew and why he knew it and all that about why why Robin Williams had to have bipolar disorder, so on and so on, and that's why he killed himself. So as a tribute to Robin Williams, good afternoon, Vietnam. How's that?
I got you. Well, keep going. Talk about this.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, at that time I was, and by the way, it's interesting. Now I have friends from Florida, East Coast, Middle United States, West Coast, all around here, scattered over the years. I am a boy from Nebraska in the middle of, like you say, not far from Kearney. It's funny, though, a lot of people do say Kearney. But at any rate, I have friends from all over, Dr. Bragan, and it's interesting how many of them recognize the Dr. Drew program, and Pinsky is his last name. People can easily Google him. But if you pay any attention to every show, this is what people are calling the Drama Drew show. And I guess the CNN has been shut down for the time being. I don't know what's going on there as far as the dry dynamics of it. But anyway, that's how we met. And I did not know that it was your wife that found the blog, but I would want to say that it was my own nephew, and I'm going to plug him right now, Daryl Cagle of CagleCartoons.com. Syndicated cartoonist. People can look it up. Cagle with a C as in Charlie. CagleCartoons.com. And it was Daryl's idea that I take that rant I had written about Dr. Drew and modified it a little bit. And he sent it out to, like he said, over 850-some stations in the United States. And your dear wife, as you say, calls it a blog. I don't even know for sure what a blog is.
I told the audience you're probably older than I am. A blog is what my wife has taught me to write, and they're like columns, but they call them blogs now. I have a blog on Huffington Post. I have a blog on Natural News, and people just learn to find them and tune into them and read them.
Well, see,
that's
here
what
in
a blog
East
is, a column.
Everything happens, yeah. Well, anyway, so whether it's Twittering or tweeting or blogging or ranting, I don't know what they all are, but I do know what I'm doing.
Well, what was so offensive about Dr. Drew diagnosing Robin Williams?
Well, you and I are both professionally trained. I'll speak for myself. And in fact, I do want your listeners to know this. Before I went into psychology, I was majoring in biology. I grew up on a farm country, and my love was wildlife. And at that time, ecology, people weren't even spelling the term, and people said, well, you know, Keene, with your interest in wildlife and biology, the thing for you to do is be a veterinarian or be a medical doctor or something like that. Well, I started in, and I ended up with a double major. This was at Nebraska Wesleyan, a Methodist private school there in Lincoln, Nebraska. And before I got my bachelor's, I had both majors in biology and psychology with minors in chemistry and German. And I still had so many interests going so many different directions, so I ended up in the same community, Lincoln, Nebraska, capital of Nebraska, University of Nebraska, and I was accepted into the biology program. And without telling the audience or even yourself, unless you're really interested, the many courses I took that were in that area, and I was teaching lab courses in zoology. Long story short, I still wasn't satisfied. I hadn't found myself, and a buddy of mine, also a farm boy, was getting his PhD at University of Nebraska in what we called rat psychology, which is experimental psychology. And I did that for an over a year, And that really was about as close as a person can get to, you might say, having really pure scientific methodology. The point I'm leading to for your audience and yourself is that from the very get-go, including in my childhood, and you might say the Ten Commandments about thou shalt not bear false witness, was telling the truth. And science, to me, was and still is the vehicle for what all of us basically rely on is facts, and not just theory or supposition or philosophy or whatever. So I have a strong background in science, and I still am very happy to say that about everything I do, and including listen to, like Dr. Drew, is it science-based. And to answer your question, he was going on and on about how he knew. Now, he didn't say that he was the doctor to Robin Williams. He just said he knew that for Robin to have killed himself, hung himself to death, however it happened, was plenty evidence that he was bipolar. Now, let's tell the audience what you and I were trained on. You and I are probably not that far apart in our ages. And you went to Harvard, and I went to Nebraska Wesleyan, University of Nebraska, and then my doctorate's from Northern Colorado. But all through those years, and again, to repeat, I was taught to be scientific in my approach. Well, what we were trained on, and I believe that you and I have already agreed to that, was one of the diagnoses at that time. It was a medical diagnosis that people who were on wild highs and wild lows were considered to be manic, depressive, and psychosis. Well, saying to somebody as a psychosis is the same as saying psychotic, and the same as saying psychotic is saying you're crazy. And I got a book, and that's a book here holding in my hand from Paula J. Kaplan, another PhD. They say you're crazy, how the world's most powerful psychiatrists decide who's normal. That was published in 1995, and there's 23 pages of bibliography there that Paula, and you know her, you said. And in that is where I learned your name, and it was Toxic Psychiatry. You want to take it from there.
Well, indeed,
it is
worth reminding folks that the history briefly of bipolar disorder, and the term was developed by Kraepelin, I believe a German psychiatrist and the most noted biological psychiatrist of his time, probably. And I think it was 1899, and he defined manic depressive disorder to distinguish it from dementia praecox or schizophrenia.
Right.
And one of his distinctions was that in the case of manic depressive disorder, there are very extreme mood swings from a very expansive high, out of control, dangerous to the person certainly and sometimes to others disorder, which he presumed to be biological to be genetic in origin, and that these swings in manic depression went from mania to depression or depression to mania. And interestingly enough, that in between there was complete recovery, and the individual, unlike the person diagnosed with schizophrenia, would go on to have a period of time, could be a lifetime, it could be weeks or months or years, of complete clarity. And this was a very major distinction. And later on, the term bipolar was created in order to find something more acceptable to the general public, because the diagnosis of bipolar, and this was done very consciously, involved people like Joseph Biederman at Harvard, who were was on the take from the drug companies. They very consciously developed the term in order to find something for which any drug could be essentially given. So if you're bipolar, according to what the drug companies inspired Biederman and others to go around and write about and lecture about, Biedermann at times was literally writing an article every 2 weeks about things like this. You have to believe he wasn't writing them. They were drug company articles with his name on it, almost certainly, which is not an uncommon practice. You could give antipsychotic drugs because it was a psychosis. You could give antidepressant drugs because it was depression. You could give anti-anxiety drugs because people were anxious. So it allowed, with both children and adults, to vastly increase the ability of the pharmaceutical industry to drug. And, folks, this is not like a conjecture on my part about Biedermann's role. I've written extensively about it. And then eventually there were hearings held looking into this by Senator Grassley, the senator from Iowa, I believe. Talk about a Republican senator from Iowa, from the heartlands. And that's really what this whole thing is about. Now, of course, the argument is that these people don't get better in between and they have to be maintained on drugs. And why is that? Well, it's because drugs don't permit recovery. Drugs don't permit recovery. And so now so-called bipolar has a whole different outlook of chronicity and deterioration, which used to be reserved for schizophrenia in the minds of the people who originated the concept. Does that sound roughly like your own understanding, Keane?
Yeah, and I wanted to interrupt, but I didn't want to interrupt when you said presumably. And I'm hoping the listeners have learned really careful critical thinking, because when you said presumably, that's an assumption. And that's the one thing that I've been trained and train others to not rely on assumptions when I work with people. People's lives are too important to rely on assumptions. And the other thing that I'm stressing, and I believe you are too, is that these labeled disorders out of the American Psychiatric Association, it's a cookbook called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM. And I believe it's now in its fifth revision, and it's become a Bible, and I'm amazed, I don't know if you are, that so many of the medical and scientifically trained people in both psychology and psychiatry, I think most people realize that psychiatry is the medical side, which should be the biological side. Well, you remember I have strong biological chemical background too, and psychology is the study of the biology of a human being. And my definition of the brain is, as I tell people, is like a computer straight off or fresh off of an assembly line. And then when we program it, then that becomes the mind. So you and I have a brain. I have every reason to believe you've got excellent neurology. Hopefully I do. And that what you and I are using and sharing with each other and your audience has to do with our mind and what we consider fact and what we consider theory and what we consider fiction. Anyway, so back to Dr. Drew. I felt here he is as a psychiatrist telling the world that he knew this and he knew that, and that just does not pass muster with me at all as far as science-based information. In fact, it's highly likely to be misinformation. What I'm really glad as a listener to you is that you're telling your audience that these psychotropic drugs, mind drugs, are not answers to people's issues. They deal only with symptoms. When you talk about anxiety, the simple word for that, doctor, is fear or worry. Well, hell, everybody worries and has fears about this from day to day. Depression, again, can be organic or biological, but I find more often than not that when people are depressed, they're sad, they're down, it's a wastebasket term. So again, I am not one to treat symptoms at all. When people come to me, I want to get at the source of it. And, you know, anytime you want, I'll tell you, how I learned, what I learned as far as my work as a counselor and in psychology.
Are you in agreement with me, Keane, that as a biologically trained person, that no so-called psychiatric disorder is known to have a biological, genetic, or biochemical basis?
Well, here's what I want to say to that. first of all, let's just start with the most simplistic understanding. You and I are biological, first and last. A sperm and an egg, I got an A in embryology, that's biology at the basis. And as that sperm and an egg becomes an embryo, then a fetus, and then a human being, of course, you know, if you're alive, you're biological. But as I was saying to you and your audience, that I look at the brain as neurology. In fact, one of my strongest interests right now is neurology and neuropsychology. So, yes, always there is a biological. But what you and I are careful about, as far as I understand from everything I've written and what you've told me so far, is that while you know that life is biology, that we, with our brains, have a mind, and early experiences and all along the way that people get in their minds, their beliefs, their feelings, their sense of their own self-concept, their sense of worth, self-esteem, negative thoughts, belief systems. Look at the politics that we're experiencing right now, last night and today.
Let me interrupt.
Go ahead.
What I'm saying is that it's not biological in the sense that a defect similar to a disease is not active in any of what we know as mental disorders. That there's been identifiable disease, disorder, dysfunction. Everything's biological. Believing in God is biological. Being an atheist is biological in the sense it takes a brain.
Right.
Rooting for the Yankees is biological, and you can't do it without a brain.
Right.
Speaking English is a biological capacity, but actually, clearly, we learn which language from our environment. What I'm saying is there's no defect for any biological abnormality that can be defined as such, or genetic. Are you in agreement with that?
Totally so. And not only do I totally so agree with that, but as far as I know, Dr. Bragan, all of the science that I've ever read, and I push people hard, whether they're PhDs, MDs, I don't care who they are, I push them to show me and explain to me science-based stuff. And you and I know that the DSM, all this labeling of people, implies to people, some people are even being told, by MDs right here in my community in southeast Idaho and in Utah, all this area, but all across the United States. I don't know what's going on in Europe and the other country, but for sure here, we're relying on the belief, which is an assumption, or you said a presumption, that there's a biochemical, neurological, which is a biological disorder or disease. And all I have to do when people call me, more often than not when I on this very phone you and I are visiting on, when people call me for appointments, they've already been told, sometimes by themselves or their own family members, you must be ADD, or you must, you know, the kids, or you must be bipolar, or you must be this, or you must be that. And most of them are even already on psychotropic drugs, and they've never been biologically assessed.
Yeah, Keen, so we got to go to break. We're a little over.
Okay.
My guest is Keen Hiftel, spelled Hueftle. Other things in Idaho. And we'll be going to break now. And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I want to remind you again that I have a new Simple Truths About Psychiatry up for the first time in many months, and it's about how much worse psychiatric drugs are than almost anyone who isn't really involved in this kind of a show, or, you know, somebody I might have on. Hardly anyone realizes how bad they are, and it just gives a little introduction to that concept in my new video, and it's a simple truth, and you can get to it on Bragan.com or on YouTube, and also to take a look at the advanced super bargains. Really, a huge bargain we're giving on my new book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. And my guest is Keen Hifto, spelled H-U-E-F-T-L-E. He's a PhD. He's in Idaho. He's a professor affiliate at Idaho State University. And as I mentioned earlier, I've been making a lot of friends out in the heartland from some of the speaking engagements I've had out there, the University of Nebraska in Kearney, and at a great rehab center in Des Moines. Keen, I interrupted him and he wanted to kind of follow up on what we were saying. Why don't you go ahead with that?
Well, yeah, we were talking, or you were explaining to the audience the meaning of disorder, and it is implying, if not stating directly to people, that when they are giving these labels, like with children, we have a lot of kids out here. Idaho and Utah have been number one in the nation in giving kids Ritalin, which is chemically methylphenidate and comes under other trade names. We've been number one and number two years after years. And it's pretty interesting, as you know, both religiously and politically, Idaho and Utah are considered, and put quotes around this word, conservative. And yet these people are not aware that what they've been told, why their children are not sitting still in school or in church or whatever. A lot of them, you know, have got too much sugar in and not near enough exercise, like we had there in Nebraska, which is on the farm you worked so hard and all the time, we didn't have these issues, and we were able to settle down. But the point is that so many people are being misled to believe that they have a biochemical problem and use the word disorder behind it. So as I started to tell people that I'm now even, if you will, making a mockery of it by saying the disorder of the DSM disorders. And people are understanding that. But once people, as you know, get this in their head, and I'm going to say it, once they get the name, they play the game. I am board certified in hypnotherapy, and I don't think people really understand or respect how powerful the human brain mind is when it comes to, once a person gets a belief, a mindset, they then, their whole perception changes as to who they are, what they are, and then they start living that, if you will, dictum. And you know, you remember what you say after you say hello, you know, the transactionals. I know you mentioned that. I'm okay, you're okay. I trained a whole week with Glenn Harris. You know, the I'm okay, you're okay. That was a very popular book. You remember reading it?
Sure.
Sure. Well, it's all about communication. It's a communication model. But I'm working on rewriting that book, by the way, Doctor, about I'm okay, you're okay. I use transaction. I'm very eclectic. Let's tell the audience that I'm very eclectic. I'm not a Johnny One Note. I know you mentioned Gestalt, which is Fritz Perls, in and out of the garbage pail. Fritz Perls was a psychiatrist. He came from Europe. He fled Nazi Germany, ended up bringing Gestalt psychology, which I use a lot, but I don't use anything exclusively when I work with people. And again, I'm going to stop with that and let you direct our conversation.
Well, we were joking during the break about, you know, calling the DSM a disorder in itself. And I said to Keen, oh, there's been much worse things said about the DSM. One
but
of
you
my
wouldn't
favorite
tell me
comparisons,
what those worst words were, though.
one of the comparisons I most enjoy and think has a lot of truth to it is the comparison between the DSM and the Malleus Malefactorum.
Okay.
Malleus Malefactorum, which was the handbook for identifying witches, the official handbook developed in Europe during the Inquisition. And it has all these different categories of witches. It has all the different treatments of witches. And ultimately, it comes down to that the trained priest or identifier of witches knows, just knows, you know, from all this information, who is a witch and who is not a witch. And, you know, I never thought of this before, but of course there were these very bizarre ideas they had that, you know, if you were thrown in a well of water and and I guess if you swam, you were a witch, and if you sank, you weren't, or something like that. It was a no win. It was certainly not a win-win. And it reminds me of the idea that, you know, if you give a kid a drug and he reacts to it, it proves he has ADHD. And, of course, if he doesn't react to the drug, you just give him a worse one. So there are some comparisons that are quite serious between an Inquisition. I've actually, in my legal an Inquisition and a psychiatric analysis or evaluation, I've actually worked in legal cases where patients were literally, who were inmates of institutions for the, quote, criminally insane, where they would literally be exposed to an Inquisition of four, five, and six people who would get them to confess to their symptoms, literally push and cajole and threaten to get them to admit to their symptoms. And, of course, many patients will tell you that the only way they got out of the mental hospital was admitting to their disease. There's a lot of similarities there to inquisitorial behavior. Akeen, is that going too far?
You know, I'm really enjoying this, and I hope as much as your other listeners are, because I do remember some of this history being taught to me as an undergraduate in psychology there in Nebraska Wesleyan, as well as follow-up stuff. I'm not as fresh with it. In fact, it's really interesting. I'm glad. In fact, I hope my friends and family are listening to you, what you're telling people, because that's exactly where psychiatry, psychology has come from. And that's the roots, and it's unfortunate that instead of going forwards with science, we've gone backwards with all of those labeling. For my classes, graduate-level class, I've been teaching here at Idaho State University, and here's the name of it, intra and interpersonal communication theory and application. And I had a bunch of metal buttons that people could put on, and wear them. I still got some here. I should send you some. Labeled jars and not people. You don't realize, again, you've heard the idiom of you get the name and you play the game. Anyway, I'll just stop there because I'm enjoying what you're saying, and I realize how accurate you're being in this whole thing of labeling people. And what, again, I'm repeating this, that we're labeling symptoms, we're not labeling etiology, the causes of it. We don't do that with Ebola. We wouldn't do that with herpes. We wouldn't do that with most truly organic or biological diseases. But psychiatry, you know, it reminds me of standing on a chasm with one leg in psychology and behavior, emotions, as you call them, and the other foot in the biology, the organic part of a human being. Take it from there.
Well, that's a good image of the maybe the chasm's widening and widening, yeah. And psychiatry is sort of in the position of when you got one arm tied to one horse and one to another, and they're going in opposite directions.
I was wondering if you were going to, you know, we're north of the Grand Canyon, and of course the deepest canyon in the world, by the way. What would you say? Do you happen to know which canyon or the river running through it is the deepest one in North America?
No, not beyond the Grand Canyon.
Well, try Hell's Canyon, which is Idaho, the border between Idaho and Oregon. I had some of my family go down that river for 4 days. It's deeper than even the Grand. Anyway, it's a metaphor, and we're both expressing this metaphor. And frankly, the medical people out here are not with you.
Using diagnoses, how do you approach understanding people? I have my own way, but how do you approach understanding people?
Okay,
from multiple viewpoints that you have. By the way, this gentleman's an expert in statistics as well as biology, plus everything from neuro-linguistic counseling to transactional analysis and gestalt
therapy.
How do you think in terms of folks when you're listening to them talk about themselves?
When I came out here, we didn't tell this, but what brought me out here in the late 60s is the largest financial federal grant in western United States, west of Mississippi. It was called the Laboratory for Children with Learning Disabilities. I interviewed and I got the directorship. And at that time, what I taught and I'd learned at Northern Colorado was differential diagnosis. Have you ever heard of that term?
I'm a medical doctor, sir.
I know, but I'm talking psychology now, not just that. Anyway,
no, I don't think psychology can do differential diagnoses, but I'm sure that was taught that way, yes.
Well, but we don't go out
that's
at it
symptomatically. That's how psychiatry thinks, too.
Well, anyway, so I'm using to answer your question, and I love the question, is I look at all human issues dynamically. Yes, we look at symptoms, and when I do my work, and the way we did it for years ago when we were doing this demonstration model here in southeast Idaho, was that we looked at the organic, if you will, the biological side of a child first. And if there were any issues there that looked at all possible, positive, then we would refer them appropriately to the medical people that we had, whether they were eye, vision, hearing, whatever. If it was truly neurological, we didn't have much going on in the way of neurology, then we would send them to the Children's University of Utah University Medical School right here, 150 miles south of us. But anyway, we used a differential model, and then what wasn't physical or organic or biological, same thing. Then the rest of the behaviors, we would look for what was going on there. And, of course, that involved what you were complimenting me on, and that I try to approach working with children with the entire family, not just with the individual. And so the answer, the short answer is I look at people dynamically, not statically. And this is a point I want to make to you and everybody. Labeling people is a static thing. Would you agree?
Oh, it's static, stultifying, and crushing.
Okay, so we more than agree. We're 2,500 miles apart from here to Kearney, Nebraska. Is a little over 800 miles. From where I'm talking to Kearney, Nebraska, would be a little over 800 miles, about 900 miles. From here to where you and I are talking, you're in Ithaca, New York, right?
Yeah.
Okay, we're over 2,000. It's about 3,000 miles across from East Coast to West Coast. So we're a long ways away, but I want to even point out the physicalness between us, electricity. You and I haven't physically met, but the vibrations that are coming through this electrical line from me to you and you to me are very physical. As I point out, again, I'm really glad for all of my biological, chemical, and even physics training because it enables me to look at things. And this is the German word, Gestalt, and you know what it means, seeing the big picture. And labeling people does not help us to see the big picture. And that's what's happening that I'm so upset about, is that whether it's bipolar or schizophrenic or ADD, as I told you, that we've been number one in the nation in giving kids Ritalin per capita, right here in Idaho and Utah. And, once these kids are put on Ritalin, then they become to believe that I'm ADD. They say it, I'm ADD. So they get the name and they play the game. And the teachers and the principals and the parents and people just fall into it. They trust authority. They trust authority out here. So if a doctor tells them or a principal or a teacher or special ed or somebody called a specialist, we get all caught up in our labels. Label jars, not people.
I know you've been out in the Midwest a lot, and you're saying out here people trust authority. It's the same in a sophisticated town like Ithaca, where Cornell is. It's the same in New York City. And in fact, I have found more trust of psychiatry among intellectuals than among heartland people. I've literally found that when I speak in the heartland and critique the psychiatric approach, and in my case also emphasize a more spiritual approach, that people are much more quickly able to grasp the damaging effects of psychiatry than the trained intellectuals in our urban centers. And also, I live in a very small town here outside of Ithaca, way outside of Ithaca. I know a lot of country people. I know a lot of conservative people. I know a range of people, people that somebody might call rednecks and so on.
You mean politically conservative?
Yeah, politically and socially and personally. And my experience is that these heartland people, heartland upstate New York, have more of a sense of the absurdity of drugging children than the Cornell medical department and other professors up here. So I just wanted to put in my two cents about the heartland. One of the nice things about this show is that it's actually taken a form, which I wasn't sure it was going to take, which is about critiquing diagnosis, and it starts on that theme with how we got in touch with my wife reading your commentary on the absurd diagnosing by Dr. Drew. And I think that it's just so important for folks listening to this to get the message that diagnosing people and being diagnosed is not a good thing in the field of mental health or personal development or psychology and psychiatry, because we're dealing with the complexities of human beings, whether you emphasize the biology or the psychosocial. What we need, from my viewpoint, is to understand the biography, the story of the person who is struggling with something, and as a struggling person, which we all are, our job is to understand our biography and to rewrite it, to rewrite our autobiography, to bring our autobiography to the place where we want it to be. And there is no escaping knowing each person's life story. There's no shortcut. There's no shorthand. There's no tag. There's no diagnosis. And I'm really glad that this hour has taken this direction to really emphasize this. And I suspect, Keene, you're on the same page with me about that.
Fully. And there's so much I would like to say to you and your audience, the listeners, how much it's good for me to hear you share this with them. And you're doing, to me, a very excellent job of articulating. The only thing is that would be the next thing is how you and I work with people. I don't know how you actually work with people, and you've never sat and watched me work with people. But, again, I'm very dynamic, and I do not use a very directive approach. I think I've told you that. I cut my teeth in Nebraska on Rogerian, which is Carl Rogers, which is a very non-directive, non-threatening, non-interpretive kind of thing. I never interpret dreams. I use a Gestalt person and have the person act out the various parts of the dreams. Now I'm telling you something I've never told you. And the interesting thing, and I tell people this, I'm going to be curious how you'll answer it, is I tell people you have the answers in you. I'm talking about, of course, children that are, say, by 12, 13, at least that age. Maybe sometimes younger, that they have. I do a lot of play therapy, too, Axline. I don't know if you were trained in Axline and play therapy. Did a lot of play therapy. And there, again, it's not directive. It's taking the child's behavior and then letting them, in a play therapy approach, act it out, which is what Gestalt psychology is that Fritz Perls brought to the United States from Europe. I'll stop again there.
Well, we've only got 3 minutes left, roughly, here.
Okay.
And I would say that I'm probably more directive I have a sense that I know the disastrous effects of abuse on people. I know how hard it is for people to talk about the abuse they've been through in childhood and later on in life often. Mm-hmm. I have a sense of the devastation inflicted by guilt, shame, and anxiety. I now even have a sense of its biological origins and through natural selection that I write about in my new book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. So I'm probably more directive, but I'm also very open, I hope, and I just have a very egalitarian relationship. I try to very, very much so with my clients. I try to just have a conversation equal to equal. But I feel like I bring a lot of knowledge that my patients benefit from, and so I'm probably less directive. I personally think this probably all has more to do with personality even than with our theories. I think we probably, as therapists, do best when we are operating in our natural personality, our natural selves, providing we're really very careful about our ethics and about our respect, you know, for the people we're dealing with. And Keen, I do have a tape called the Empathic Therapy Training Tape where people can see somewhat of how I do interact with people. But it isn't Rogerian, but I respect whatever approach people find their power in, their comfort in, their ability to help people with. We have about 30 seconds left. You could respond to that, Keen, if you like.
I'm going to real quickly. My motto, I came to it years ago. It's on my stationery, now on my business card, helping people to become their own best friend.
I think that's a marvelous motto. I think there are a lot of mottos along that line. And I think of it as helping empower people to live the lives they want to live. So I have a little bit of field marshal in my personality, which is unusual for a therapist. You know, I'm a reformer. I spent a lot of my life dealing with power. And I think in terms of people taking charge of their lives and having power to take their lives in the directions they want to.
You emphasize, though, empathetic.
Very much so. Empathic, really putting yourself in that other person's shoes. And then I think in terms of helping them understand maybe what their next step is. What is it? But see, again, that's somewhat directive in that I have a concept that I'm in your shoes, and I'm also going to help you maybe take that next step you hadn't thought about or you were afraid of, and let's see what it might be.
Well, selfishly, I wish this conversation between us could go on.
Well, you know, it can. We will find ways to do that. Let me tell you who my guest is. He is Dr. M. Keen, K-E-E-N-E, Hüftl, H-U-E-F-T-L-E. Your practice is in Idaho. People can find you on the web. It's been a delight to have you on. And hello to the heartland. My heart is in part in the heartland. Thanks very, very much.